I remember a time of chaos, ruined dreams, this wasted land. But most of all, I remember the Road Warrior, the man we called Max. To understand who he was, you have to go back to another time.
Welcome to the Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast, Mad Max Retrospective Series.
Not this again! I've been assigned!
Join Garrett.
Perfect in every way.
Matt.
You. It's your lucky day.
And the returning Mick Duffy.
Remember me?
As they review the franchise that revolutionized low-budget filmmaking.
Hey, listen, man, will you listen to me?
From the gritty 1979 Mel Gibson starring original.
I've seen the style before, Terminal Psychotic.
To the 2015 mega hit, Mad Max Fury Road.
Max. My name is Max.
All the way to George Miller's prequel, Furiosa.
This one has all their teeth.
The boys will review each film in the series, one car chase at a time, to see why and how this franchise just keeps on going.
Together they can be very powerful.
So strap yourself in, percolated media listeners.
What are you doing? Praying to who? Anyone that's listening.
The Three Men and a Retrospective Mad Max series begins now.
Now we bring home the booty!
Mad Max 2, or as that's known here in the States, Road Warrior, released December 24th, 1981. Budget on this was $4.5 million box office. In total, $36 million in U.S. dollars. And this was directed once again by George Miller. Mick, I want to go to you right off the bat. Did they rename this Road Warrior just for United States purposes?
Yes, purely for North America. Simply because, you know, the filmways had... As we discussed, distributed the first film. I just turned into Daffy Duck there for some bizarre reason. They handled the first film in North America, but they'd given it a redub, dubbing it into American English, and it only played grindhouses and drive-ins. So, yeah, North America's the only place where the first film wasn't sort of this breakaway, low-budget hit and was obscure. So, yes, they needed to rename it. And so far as I can tell... Them actually coming up with the name Road Warrior must have been fairly late in the day. I was reading, you know the film historian Christopher Freeling?
Yeah.
Yeah, in one of his books on Sergio Leone, he talks about encountering George Miller. This was around the time this film was being released in the UK, and Miller telling him they still hadn't decided what to call it in the US. And Freeling gave him a joke title that they didn't use, obviously. Freeling, noticing that both films were a bit Sergio Leone, said that they should call the second one For a Few Gallons More.
Wow.
Yeah.
Matt, what's your history with Road Warrior or Mad Max 2, whatever we want to call it? Did you see this like immediately after the first one? Did you give it a few days? How did you see Road Warrior?
I think I saw this movie with millions of other people on HBO because this has to hold a record or be in the top five for the movie that I saw basically every time I would turn on HBO on a Saturday afternoon just on a whim. This thing was playing constantly. And I don't think I ever saw it in one shot. I just kept seeing maybe 5 or 10 minutes of every time I'd turn it back on and off. Basically means you could watch the whole movie and go by that speed anywhere from a little over a week to 2 weeks based on how much you're watching. But it was something that I didn't realize it was connected to the previous movie because it's titled here in America as just The Road Warrior because us dumb Americans had no idea really what Mad Max was. So they gave it a title that a couple years later, the guys Hawk and Animal would run with, and it would certainly carry a whole lot more. And quite frankly, if Hawk and Animal were in this movie, it wouldn't be all that surprising with all the with this cast of characters in the wasteland.
Yeah, definitely. You could definitely see this movie's influence on their careers, for sure. And it's funny you mentioned that about HBO, because I have that exact story for next week's film. But we'll get to that next week. Mick, you've been teasing us for a little bit of over a year and a half in our little chat that we have, that you have a Mel Gibson story that you've been wanting to tell. I think it's fitting, since this is the movie. Last week's movie definitely started the star-making quality that Mel Gibson would eventually have, but this one kind of cemented it. What is your Mel Gibson story?
Okay, so in the final year of me studying for my Bachelor of Arts in Film and Media Studies at the University of Stirling in Scotland, that's my final year there, that's 1995, mm-hmm. A thing happened in university politics. The student members of the Student Labour Society, as in the Labour Party, had nominated somebody really, really boring to be the honorary president of the university. And I can't even remember the person's name, only that it was a really dull choice, and it struck me as somebody who was both very boring and also just probably wouldn't have the time to turn up to meetings. And I just thought that was annoying, and there were a bunch of things on campus I wanted to see fixed, and I figured that, well, you know, if the right person got this post, they could just hold up meetings until, you know, there was better places to lock up bicycles, better lighting at the bus stop, you know, those sort of issues. Mm-hmm. And I discovered that there was no provision against students running for honorary president. I just needed to get an arbitrary number of signatures from other students, and I could run for the post of honorary president. And I thought, well, gosh, this is clearly the only course of action, because I'm the only person I know whom I can rely upon to turn up and do this stuff. So I did this. I decided, okay, I'm going to run, and I threw my hat into the ring. But turns out I wasn't the only person who thought the boring Labour candidate shouldn't become honorary president. Now, at this time, this is the mid-90s in Scotland, the Scottish Nationalist Party are kind of becoming stronger and more powerful. And that's obviously the party that wishes Scotland wasn't run by England. A sentiment I share, without actually much caring for that party, but this coincided with, you know what I said, 1995, so you can see where this is going, right?
Yeah, that was the year Braveheart,
no,
too.
That's the year Braveheart was shot. 96 is the year it came out, and Stirling is famously the site of the Battle of Stirling Bridge, maybe William Wallace's most famous battle. And, you know, there is if you go to Stirling and you should, it's lovely. For most parts of Stirling, you can see there's a large tower on a prominent hill. It's the Wallace Monument. It's named after William Wallace. And you can go inside and you can see purportedly what was his broadsword, which I should add is taller than Mel Gibson.
Wow.
He's not that tall, though. But anyway, so someone in the SNP student organization managed to get in touch with Mel Gibson. And they faxed the forms over to Icon Productions, and Mel Gibson faxed them back and signed, and suddenly Mel Gibson was also running for the post of honorary president.
Shit.
So I am at this point moving from being cautiously optimistic about my chances to, you know, being a little more circumspect and thinking, okay, well, you know, I'll give this my best shot. I did reorient a lot of my marketing materials for my campaign around generally mocking Mel Gibson. So I remember one of the posters was, I had just taken one of the publicity stills from Road Warrior, I replaced Gibson's head with mine, as an amusing joke. And as this went on, the race kind of started getting crazier. And at one point, I'm not saying I'm taking full credit for this thing happening, because it's entirely possible somebody else made this check, but I noticed that in the actual bylines that it had to be a physical signature for my form, that it couldn't be photocopied, it couldn't be faxed, they needed an actual signature. So I remember asking someone in the student council if they had received an actual signed form from Mel Gibson, or if it was a fax, and turns out he'd only sent a fax over. And the deadline had, they didn't get in touch with him again in time for him to get his proper paperwork in, so he was withdrawn.
Uh-huh.
But for a time, I was running in a public contest against Mel Gibson, and the election came round, and do you know who won the election?
Not you.
Yeah, Ron won the election. That's reopened nominations. So they opened the nominations
again. They opened
again.
Them again.
By this stage, Mel Gibson's too busy in pre-production on Braveheart, which, by the way, is mostly shot in Ireland, so it's not even like he's anywhere nearby. And by this stage, other people have noticed that there's no bylaw prohibiting students from running. So I've broken student politics at this point, because lots of other students are now running. And at any rate, he didn't get in that year. I can't remember who became honorary president. Possibly the boring person I was trying to prevent. But at that point, it wasn't Mel Gibson, which was a relief, because much as I like many of the films he'd made prior to that point, it's not some of his politics,
yeah.
Especially his crazy, crazy... does the term tradcast mean anything to you gentlemen?
Yes.
Yeah, his crazy tradcast beliefs always just seemed deeply suspect to me. So, yeah, I was glad he at least didn't get in. And yeah, but then next year when I was in a run to prevent these things, he ran again and clearly filed the correct paperwork and became honorary president. And it's just humiliating. It's just embarrassing, especially now considering the man's current...
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, if you had waited like 10 years, you would have run away with it.
Oh, yeah.
God, that's funny. Mick, what is your history with The Road Warrior? Did you rent this? Did you see this back-to-back with the original?
This would have been the first one of these films I saw. And I saw it literally on my 14th birthday. Okay. So, I hadn't seen any of the other films at that point. But I'd read the novelization of the third one.
Oh, okay.
Remember novelization?
Yeah, I had a ton of them.
Yeah, I'm saying all of these words, and honestly, it's a full-on... my life fades, division dims, kind of feeling. These things have all been swept away.
You know? I watched this back-to-back with the original, again, preparing for a movie we're going to discuss in a couple of weeks. I'll get into my thoughts. My thoughts haven't changed much since. It was one of those movies that, when it was over, I was like, so this was the big hubbub? It was an interesting experience watching it for that first time, but there's not really much to discuss with the history of this. The original comes out, and then George Miller, he gets his production company together, and they, within a couple years, put this out. The original got such good buzz in the United States that they decided to release it here, but again, the production company decided to change the name for the United States, and Matt, you hit it right on the head. You changed the name just because people wouldn't associate it with Mad Max. I find that weird. Matt, is it safe to say that this is kind of a soft reboot of that previous movie?
No, because it is very much a sequel, but it's only a soft reboot in the way of introducing it to American audiences, because Mad Max was not ultimately successful here. In fact, it kind of came and went. So, you know, this kind of did change the direction of the franchise, because I think in a lot of ways this one in pop culture certainly has more iconic stuff in it by comparison to the original.
For sure. Yeah, it definitely has an influence. We've already mentioned the Road Warriors, obviously, but there's many more even after that. I guess you could say post-punk culture really benefited from this movie.
I mean, this set the paradigm for a lot of post-apocalyptic type of films. I mean, they were making rip-offs of this movie well into the noughties with, what was that Neil Marshall
Doomsday.
Movie?
Doomsday.
I mean, that's like the love child of Escape from New York and the Road Wars, and it's also fucking terrible.
I saw that in theaters.
Yeah.
It's really bad.
Me too. And I saw
it as well.
So we were the three. All right, so we open up. We got the Warner Brothers logo that I actually associate with Superman, the red that dissolves into the white.
Oh, you saw that logo?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, right, because it's not... I think on my Blu-ray, but it's just got like a more modern Warner Brothers logo on it, and I was bereft.
Okay, yeah, I watched this. I believe I watched it on Amazon.
Ah.
As the credits start, we get a voiceover, and this is new. You know, we got to reintroduce people to the world that we're in.
It's always a bit of a interesting paradigm when I look at it, because you would think with how society is depicted in the first one, how it's kind of on the verge of collapse, you think this is how they would have opened the first movie to kind of establish what the state of the world is. But I like how, and this sort of ties into my overall thoughts in the movie, I like how this movie is treated much more as like folklore, almost like a campfire story, and how Max, in the first one, he's much more of a quote-unquote character. Whereas here, I like how he's treated as myth, sort of like the Clint Eastwood. I mean, there's a lot of Clint Eastwood in this movie, both with his performance and with how this world is depicted. But I like how the narration makes this feel almost like myth and legend, while also letting you know that, yeah, the world has gotten even crazier since the last time you were in it.
Yeah, no, I love the opening montage and narration in this film, and it's especially great if, I don't know if either of you have seen this film in 35mm. Mm. Because the opening of the film is in 4x3.
Oh, wow.
So we've got, you know, and if you see this in the theater, the screen is only yay wide for this whole opening montage. And the effect's lost if you're watching this in any home format. But in the cinema, you know, the original idea was that the curtains would be drawn back to close at the boundaries of the 4:3 frame, so that, you know, when the montage ends and we fade to black and come back up and we're in Max's world in sort of the present of the story, you know, the film has suddenly become widescreen.
Oh, interesting.
And I love that. I saw this, first time I saw this film in 35mm, that moment, which I didn't realize was coming. You know, I didn't realize, I'd only ever seen the film on VHS beforehand, and obviously panned and scanned. So that moment, that thing that takes us out of the montage into Max's world, it's incredible if you see that in a large auditorium on a screen. But no, I love this montage. I love the way they've creatively used all the exciting shots from the first film.
Mm-hmm.
All of them, apart from the tooth cutter's death, are in there. Yeah. I like the fact that they've used stock, you know, when their narrator's explaining the collapse of civilization, that they're using newsreel and news footage that even then would have been old.
Yeah, good point.
I think that's such a smart move. Rather than them using, you know, like, contemporary footage of something that had happened recently, like, say, you know, the revolution in Iran or something that had happened within the last year or two, that it's all kind of things from, like, I think there's footage of France and Algeria, that war. You know, there's footage of some riots from, I think, maybe 1968 in Paris in it. There's a couple of things I recognize within it, but none of it's from, like, 1980 or 81. It's all already in the past. And I think that really helps sell the idea that this is the before times.
Yeah, I found it interesting that these are the words of the feral kid that we're going to be meeting throughout the course of this film. So it's bookended by somebody who Max interacts with throughout the course of the movie. That was an interesting way to start. I didn't realize that's who it was until I watched it for this particular podcast. So we're hearing that in the aforementioned voiceover, that all that remains are memories and that dreams are wasted on this land. And the only thing he remembers is the road warrior named Max. We're hearing that all steel was swept away as the machines were blown away by the chaos of war. Fear and looting erupted, and the roads were a nightmare as gangs took over the highways. Yeah. As Mick mentioned, we're getting shots of Max with his wife, and we're hearing that he's a desolate man haunted by demons from his past, but it was here where he learned how to live again. So this is all setting us up for what we're going to get. And even if you hadn't seen that movie, I guess this is a good setup for that, right, Matt?
Yeah, it is, but also in a lot of ways, it gives you all the important information, so you can kind of skip the first movie if you want to and go straight to this one.
Yes.
Which does benefit the name change of not being associated with the original, so it kind of gives it, to use a road pun, it's like a yield sign where you wait and you can go right to this one.
Yeah, and also I think it proves that men will wander into the wasteland and they're in that barren place, learn to live again, rather than go to therapy.
Yes. We cut to Max on the highway, and right away I have a compliment to give. Of course, this scene is yet another great way to start the film, but I also noticed that the score is much better this time. We have the same composer here, Brian May, but I thought his themes and haunting strings were a hell of a lot better this time than the cacophony of last week. Mick, would you agree that the score is much better here?
The score is a lot better. The score also, it borrows a lot from, there's a section of his planet suite, Mars, the Bringer of War, and it borrows a lot from that, which is fine because film scores do that. Yeah, no, it's a better score. It's exciting. I also like the fact that, certainly if you're watching this film, like on 35mm, this score is in stereo. Yeah. Feels a lot more urgent and exciting.
Yeah. We're getting POV shots as the dog is in the front seat, which I liked. But he gets in the background as Max is trailed by a motorcycle and a car and runs them off the road. Nice shot of this car flipping. Again, Mick, we are starting off with a hell of an action scene here, aren't we?
Right. And again, here's the thing. You know, with this movie being Australian and leaning on Australian cars, I looked up the model of that car that was flipped because I didn't recognize it. And it's something that I think is called the Ford Lander. They only made 1,400 of them. And I'm like, it's entirely possible there's none of those left now. Right? So I like the idea that this film was helping to reduce the amount of surviving 1970s Australian muscle cars.
Interesting. Matt, how'd you feel about this opening?
Oh, it's great. And once again, it emphasizes that even in a desolate wasteland, they are still better drivers than most Americans.
Damn right. We're then seeing two people on a motorcycle with one yelling and both of them wearing BDSM gear. And I have to say, this movie feels a hell of a lot more punk than last week's did.
Oh, yeah. I gotta say, the costume design in this film is so much
fun.
And really influential. And, costume designer Norma Morricone deserves all the props for the work she did here. It's not just that there's weird S&M gear, which is sort of instantly distressing in this context. It's little things as well. Like, everyone points out the sports padding, but nobody notices the, Wes, the sort of main biker character, the sort of secondary antagonist who's introduced here. He's also wearing carpet on delay. As armor.
That's funny.
If you look at it, it's carpet underlay, yes. Yeah. I just, which would work. I like this. I like the idea that he's made found armor out of bits of scrap, you know.
This is one of those movies that sort of set the precedent for a lot of stuff you would get in the 80s. Everything from the Warriors to, like I mentioned, LOD. There's just so much stuff you can harken back to for this. And I also love that that guy, this is, I guess this was his niche, because he also plays the secondary villain in Commando.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Vernon yeah. Wells, yes.
Kind of Vernon Wells.
Yeah.
Kind of progressive, because clearly they are in a homosexual relationship of some kind. And the movie, I'm not going to say it doesn't draw attention to it, but it's clearly, you don't have to stare too long to read into it all that much. And I mean, that's pretty progressive also for the time. This is the early 80s, remember that.
I always watch it, and I always have a question of consent. Like, Does the blonde-haired guy riding Pinion with Wes really want to be there?
Yeah. And even the guy who plays Wes, I mean, he was even asked about this, and he has said, you know what, I had no idea, but George Miller was like, oh yeah, that was the full intent. Like, I don't know who to believe here. I do like this shot of this motorcycle taking off. Just, again, amazing stunts in this movie. God.
Yeah. Do you know how they cast the golden youth he's riding with Wes?
No.
Apparently he was a courier. He turned up to deliver something to the officers of Kennedy Miller Productions, and went, "Oh yes!" They just liked the look of him and thought he'd be perfect for this role with no dialogue.
They thought he'd be perfect in this role with no dialogue.
Yeah, well, you know, they thought he had the right look,
yeah,
which
is going to look good, and they had to make sure the prop boomerang wound fit in his head later on.
Yeah, we'll get there. We hear some shrieking, and Max looks to see a bloody hand reaching up through the wreckage. This movie is kind of horror-based, you know? I mentioned last week that George Miller was just kind of walking through the offices while Spielberg was looking at directors to do the Twilight Zone, the movie, and Spielberg was like, hey, I really like that Road Warrior movie you made. Like, why don't you work on this movie? Like, Matt, would you agree this is kind of horror-based?
It's a lot of things under the guise of just being a top-notch action movie, because this is also a Western. You can look at it as a buddy cop movie,
yeah,
if you really want to read into it. You know, you can look at this as men on a mission. There's plenty of biblical stuff in this. It's a gang movie. It's a lot of things at once, but first and foremost, it is just a balls-to-the-wall action movie that is far more streamlined than a lot of stuff you get nowadays. I mean, this thing clocks in at just about 90 minutes. And you can summarize the plot in two sentences, which I very much appreciate after talking about all these goddamn nitty-gritty Star Wars movies.
Oh, yeah, very. In fact, there's one shot in this which really recalls a shot in Night of the Living Dead.
Yes.
You know, there's the abandoned sort of Mac truck on the road. And when Max opens the door of it and the driver falls out in quite a state of decay, it's shot very much like the scene in Night of the Living Dead.
Good call.
Where Ben finds the corpse on the stairs in the farmhouse.
We see Max pick up a music box and use it. I feel like this is the only time we really see Max's humanity emerge. You know, this will help get him acquainted with a little boy who, as I mentioned, is the narrator of this movie. But later on, we'll see him actually eat dog food. I feel this is Miller's way of illustrating whatever humanity this ex-cop had in the last film is almost completely gone.
I think that's evident, and you can also read into it that he barely talks. I think he has, what, 19 lines
something
in this
like
movie or something like that? It's sort of the, you know, like Schwarzenegger in the first Terminator, or even, you know, a lot of Clint Eastwood's early westerns. He really does not talk a whole lot. So they're very much echoing that style of the silent, stoic hero. And I think and it's not because he has fewer dialogue. I think he's substantially better in this movie as far as like screen presence and things like that than he is in the first one. He looks a lot more comfortable.
Definitely. Got a good haircut, too.
Yeah, he's got the Reed Richards gray streak stuff.
Nice reference.
Oh, yeah.
Mick, you would agree he's better here? And how do you feel about his humanity in this?
Yeah, no, Gibson is better in this film. He actually feels like a sort of laconic presence in a way he did not in the first film. And also, and I think we might have to chalk this up to terrible lifestyle choices, but in the 2 or 3 years since they filmed the last motion picture, he seems to have aged a decade. He's still only 25 in this, but man, that's a rough-looking 25.
Well, you got to imagine, too. I mean, he's filming out in this desert, and that just doing that alone must age you, you know, filming a movie like this. We cut to Max driving, and he finds some sort of sit-down helicopter. He approaches it with a tire iron and reaches for a snake as a man emerges and tells him to put it down. Now, this is Bruce Spence, or the gyro captain, as he's known in this film. I'm not sure I like characters like this, because while it's funny to be quirky, you kind of need something to grasp onto if I'm going to like you as a character. And this guy, he's not that kind of character. Let's just put it that way. How do we like Bruce Spence in this film?
I love Bruce Spence in this film.
Do you?
Yeah, I love Bruce Spence in this movie. I think it's perfectly judged, over the top, but still sort of characterful performance. It's not sucking up all the oxygen, but it's still very prominent. And it's, again, we've mentioned Clint Eastwood films, and I think throughout this movie, there's a dynamic between Max and the gyro captain that seems to consciously recall the dynamic between Clint Eastwood and Eli Wallach's character in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. You know, where sometimes they're holding the other one at gunpoint. Sometimes they have an allegiance. There's this sort of back and forth. And I think if you've got a laconic hero, you need to push all of the sort of a quirk up on some of your other characters to make them seem cooler, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I equate this to, like, a lot of the more eccentric Bond sidekicks. Like, you know, there's the tennis player and Octopussy that was around this time. I also like that, you know, because the world is much more heightened and accentuated, it wouldn't just be the villain characters who are these over-the-top personas. You know, yeah, this guy is not a good person, I wouldn't imagine. But I also like the thing of, even though everyone else has mastered the roads, we have someone else who mastered the sky when civilization collapsed. So I like that paradigm and putting these two characters together. It's also the closest thing this movie has to any sense of comic relief or humor. And I think if you remove him, it becomes, I'm not going to say the movie suffers considerably because of it, but you would feel that lack of levity. And by the way, if you, Bruce Spence has done like every bit role you can do in these big movies.
Except, in Star Wars, too.
Yeah, he's in like one scene in Star Wars. He got cut from Lord of the Rings, which I can't believe Peter Jackson actually cut something from those movies. And then you realize, you look at the extended cuts, you go like, oh my god, he cut damn near an hour and a half out of every movie. He also did a voice in Finding Nemo. I don't know which one it is.
Did he really?
I think he's one of the sharks.
Yeah, he's one of the sharks. He's not the main one. I think he's one of the...
No. But he's also in one of the Matrix sequels.
Yeah, he's the train.
Oh yeah,
he's the train
driver. Yeah, so he's actually turned up on all of the core sci-fi franchises apart from Star Trek. I think he has at this point. He's such a fun character actor. I love it when he turns up and stuff. Literally the most heartbroken I've ever heard any filmmaker I know sound is a director I know, and I'm not going to mention because then everyone will figure out who the actor whom he had to get to replace Spence was. But a director I know was some years ago was making a film, and he'd managed to secure Bruce Spence for one of the roles. And sadly, a conflict came up, and someone else had to fill the role. And just honestly, when he mentioned this to me, he just sounded just desolate. And I can completely relate. He's a really fun actor who can do an awful lot with very little.
When you say conflict, do you mean schedule conflict?
Yeah,
or an actual...
Conflict. Yeah, yeah. There's something else, something... I can't even remember now what it was, but something... one of those larger films he sometimes turns up in. I think one of those, something that just... Something that you couldn't let an actor turn down, or that he'd already committed to.
Max says that those tanks are booby-trapped, and Gyro doesn't believe him, but he does back him up, saying that he has brains, not reflexes. The dog, who is just named Dog, he then emerges, and he gives up that there's thousands of miles of fuel, the location he won't give up unless he can join Max on the journey. So here's his sidekick, as Matt mentioned.
Yeah, and it's weird here, because we've got two concessions to audiences who don't speak Australian English here.
Yeah,
and
good call.
One of them is that they, instead of talking about petrol, which is what people in Britain, Ireland, and Commonwealth countries call that stuff you put in cars, they've kind of made up a new term, guzzoline.
Yes.
Which is great. And the other one is, Australia went fully metric in 1974. There's no reason for the gyro captain to be talking about miles, except it would confuse American audiences if he did.
Or gallons.
Or kilometers. Yeah, it's kind of, it's one of those things where I'm like, okay, they're talking about miles, even though all the road signs we see in these movies say kilometers. Okay, fine.
Exactly. Yeah. I like this booby trap in the car involving a gun. That was a cool little trap there. There's a lot of creative stuff in this film.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's like the first one where you can tell James Wan loves these movies. Because some
exactly.
Throughout the Saw movies. I mean, hell, the movie we're going to talk about next week is like Jigsaw's Wet Dream.
Can we talk about the dog?
Yeah.
You know what breed of dog that is, right?
No,
is no, that? It looks like a mix.
It's a blue heeler, which is an Australian cattle dog. They're called blue heelers. So this is canonically the kind of dog that Bluey is, if you're familiar with the children's animated series Bluey.
No.
Oh yeah, Harrison watches that a lot. It's like the greatest kid show as far as, like, giving you much more than what you would expect.
Yeah, it is terrific, but it's kind of, it's one of these, I think everyone who isn't Australian watches this film and just assumes the dog is a mutt, but if you're Australian, it's, like, maybe the most iconic Australian dog breed. So it's one of these things that kind of, I think the rest of the world kind of doesn't pick up on, but Australians would have been, oh, right, of course he'd have one of those.
They go to a cliff, and Gyro says, there it is, as bikers and cars, they surround the factory. And this is also when we see Humongous, who's wearing a hockey mask Jason Voorhees would actually wear a couple years later. This was cool to see. Now, Mick, is it true this was going to be his partner from the last film, correct? And they just kind of changed that at the last minute?
Well, not so much last minute. That's one of the rumors I've heard. What is true is that originally they had intended to cast Roger Ward, who played Captain Fifi in the original film, as Humongous. So if you can remember the strange energy he brought to that role as Max's boss. And his, I think last time we were discussing him, I think I used it for his leather daddy.
Yes.
And again, I can imagine him in this getup, in this kind of bondage harness and the hockey mask. I can't imagine him wearing it as well. You know, the guy they've got here, Kjell Nilsson, who was a, I want to say Swedish bodybuilder, had been in Australia for the, either for an Olympics that had just passed or they were coming up, but he's a, you know, Scandinavian bodybuilder. He'd relocated to Australia. And I think this is his only film credit, and he's great. He's just perfect.
Yeah, I like him in this.
It's this character concept that could have gone just so horribly wrong, and yet is absolutely perfect. Is it the weird disconnect between the way he looks, where he's this, you know, a terrifying appearance, but also the fact that he's so articulate?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
he's great at doing speeches.
Yeah, that's a template for Bane, isn't it, Matt?
You just stole my mind, motherfucker.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, but literally, it's that thing, you know, you think he would sound like, you know, how Bane is in Batman and Robin, not the one in Dark Knight Rises who sounds like he went to Oxford. This could have gone horribly wrong. And what I mean by that is, even though this world is considerably more over the top than what it is in the first one, to have, like, a hulking mutant, for all intents and purposes, be your big villain wearing this hockey mask and basically nothing else. This could have been too far for the context, but given the fact that the rest of his gang is of a similar level of absurdism, he doesn't stand out as much despite being considerably the biggest among all of them. So yeah, I think this is of a lot of things that are remembered from this movie, this is one of the more iconic ones, and I think it's well deserved. And this also set the template for a lot of the big villains of this era, where they have to be these giant, either boogeymen or these, you know, monsters. I mean, this one, a lot of ways, is kind of the precursor to the Terminator, if you think about it. Like, you got a foreign bodybuilder he talks, and when he talks, you listen. It's more of the, when he talks, you pay attention, because he talks a lot more than you would think, but not enough, like, Bane, where you're like, oh my god, just shut up. Nothing you're saying makes any sense, either.
I think the question with the Humongous is, was he even more buffed before the apocalypse? Right? Like, was he just insanely ripped before the apocalypse? And, you know, presumably, because one would assume afterwards it's harder to get, you know, whey powder and, you know, sources of protein. Or did he use the apocalypse as a chance to finally get the body he always dreamed of?
Mick, pick up the prequel comics, which I'm sure are out there. You can probably find out that answer.
Yeah, I don't want the answer to this question, but yeah. There is one concept they sort of dropped from the Humongous, that there's kind of a trace element of it still in, but originally, the back of his head, which would have a slightly more elaborate makeup design, they had actually designed a sort of rig where there were going to be, like, sort of prosthetic veins pulsing, as if there was something much more seriously wrong with him than merely burns, but it didn't quite work, so it's not really in the film.
Did they start filming and then they decided to drop it, or did they drop it in the developing stage?
I think it was when they started filming it. I remember reading Image Effects, this sort of Australian makeup and prosthetic company that worked on this movie, had built something. I think there's one shot where there's the back of his head. You can kind of sort of see that there's some very well-defined veins, but they're not really doing much. So I don't know if that was a shot where the appliance was still in, but it didn't really work as intended. But, you know, it doesn't need to be more elaborate than it is. We don't need to see any of his appearance. We get the general gist that he's probably horribly burned under that thing. So
yeah, and he's definitely imposing. So you don't really need a backstory to see how imposing and threatening this guy actually is. We cut to Max planning his attack as he's looking through some binoculars and opening up a can of dog food. And God, this poor dog, he must be starving. That's all I think of when I see dogs like this. Gyro reaches for the can as the dog is eating out of it, and anyone who has a dog knows that this is never a good idea. Although apparently this dog was so nice that they really had to edit to make it look threatening in this spot. That's what Bruce Spence says in interviews that I watched for this podcast. This dog was apparently like the sweetest dog you could imagine, so they really had to cut around that. They wake up and see more cars just surrounding the compound, and I have to say, this compound looks really cool lit up.
Yeah.
Nick, did they film this in, where did they film this, Australia?
They filmed this, in near, there's a sort of small city in New South Wales called Broken Hill, and they filmed it within driving distance of that. And this was at the point the largest set ever built for an Australian film.
Oh, really?
This at that point was the most expensive Australian film that had ever been made, which is sort of hilarious because I think the rest of the world looked at this movie and thought, yeah, we could make something like that for, you know, $1 million and some dune buggies. But the one thing I like just about, you know, when Max wakes up and it's this very brief detail and it's only on screen for a couple of seconds, but the fact that Max is basically wearing a poncho when he wakes up, that he's got a grey blanket that he's cut a hole in the middle of to put his head through. So I like for a few seconds in this, he really is in Clint Eastwood in a spaghetti western.
Good call.
Mode.
Yeah,
tutorial.
Nice association.
Yeah. Literally the poncho he gets in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Yeah.
And knowing George Miller, that couldn't have been coincidental, huh?
No, yeah. No, it feels very deliberate.
And for the record, unlike a certain movie we talked about, that's a great example of a prequel giving you details and not harking on them very much.
Max wakes up again and sees a car heading his way. He gets up and sees that the car is completely taken out and somebody's being dragged from it. Now, this chick is being raped, right?
Oh, yeah. This is,
yes.
Shows how far the world has fallen, that sexual violence of this extreme is just treated so nonchalantly by, like, Max.
Yeah.
Like, even he's desensitized by it.
Yeah, I mean, we had one of these last week, but this seems even more gratuitous this time.
Yeah, it's very early 80s in its gratuitousness, this sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the one scene in this that isn't fun, but at least there's a teensy bit of levity in the middle of it, with a Max watching with the binoculars and realizing that the gyro captain has taken out a very large telescope,
yes.
And then swapping with him so he can have a better look. That's a
that is a good moment. Yeah,
it's the darkest joke in this movie, though.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So we see Wes and his partner. They drive away from the scene, and a crossbow is pointed at the woman, and she is completely taken out. Max makes his way down, bad leg and all, as he takes out a guard with his crossbow. He tells a survivor that he's just here for the gasoline. He's told to take whatever he likes as Max releases him.
It's also very important because, much like a lot of, you know, the characters that in Westerns they're harkening to, he's still a very selfish character. Like, even
definitely.
When he gets wrapped up in this cause, he's like, I'm just doing this for the gasoline, which is a substitute for money. Like, still not a very likable person.
Yeah, for the title character, he really is not very likable. I've noticed that. And he's more of a reactionary character than he is actually a lead.
He's not terribly sympathetic.
Which is even more surprising considering the last movie we watched his family get brutally murdered.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We didn't see the feral boy for the first time. He trails Max as he enters the compound with the body of the guy he has just killed. And he's taken into custody for his trouble.
Oh, I love this, you know, the shot when the feral kid sees Max? And how he's framed with the sort of decaying fence posts in front of him. It's a big shout out to the film Shane.
Oh, wow.
When the kid in Shane sees Shane for the first time, it's the framing consciously, you know, evoking that movie. And apparently Shane is one of the films Miller had his cast and crew watch when they were prepping this.
I need to watch that again. I haven't seen it since I was a little kid.
Yeah, it feels very much like, you know, the dynamic where Shane is kind of, again, not really a good person, but this kid hero worships him because he's so good at killing.
Well, the reason why I like this kid and I like having him around, because as I mentioned earlier, it's kind of his one last link to humanity, because he's, like I said, he's eating dog food, he's living off the society around him, and there's not really much left over from the guy we met in that first film, and this kind of brings him back to that.
Yeah, and I'm surprised you like this, because I know you hate kids in movies in most ways.
Well, if they're used right, I like it.
Yeah, because this kid's actually useful.
Yeah, exactly.
But he's both useful and also annoying, so I think you get both things. You get both sides are pleased based on what your own preference is.
Oh, yeah, wait till the end. I have words about that for sure. Max tries reasoning with the guys in the compound. He says he wants his gas as he had an arrangement, but the guy he brought back dies, and Max is told that the contract he had with him died along with him. The dog then attacks as we follow some rabbits for some reason, and Max is cuffed to a truck. We see another gang, this one led by Humongous, the Ayatollah of Rock and Rolla. And they approach with bodies riding on the front of vehicles. And this is definitely a visual we'll be seeing again.
Yeah. And do we reckon, one of the victims strapped to one of the fronts of the Horde's vehicles? Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is our first instance in this franchise of an actor from one of the previous films coming back, but in a different role.
What did he play previously?
Yeah, the defiant victim, the one who's shouting and complaining, he's the guy who played Benno, who was like Ma Swayze's son, or possibly grandson in the first film, you know, who had some kind of unspecified developmental issue. So it's the same guy.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It's Max Fairchild, who, again, it's a very different role, and it's a small role, and his previous role was so small, so I guess they figured they could use him again, and no one would make the connection.
And you know what? We see this a lot. If you have these actors and you're in a certain part of the world where you can't get many more actors, you use the ones you can. So I can definitely see why they did this. Humongous says that this is the Valley of Death, and he rules the wasteland, and he will not be defiled.
You know, it's again, he's such a fun public speaker. I think this is one of the motifs in this franchise. Demented, insane warlords being really great at giving speeches.
Yes, we'll definitely be seeing that next week.
You know, even to the extent that there's the character inside the compound, the older gentleman in the old military helmet, you know, he's got that line about, this humongous seems like a reasonable fella. I love that moment. I love the idea that, yes, of course, the humongous seems so reasonable. This is clearly a reflection of how badly political discourse got before the end. You know, the humongous is probably a moderate.
I love how for a movie that's predicated on action, and that's really the thing that when this movie gets appraised, it's most known for, this movie is still incredibly quotable.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Like, which is really impressive.
Most of the quotes I pulled for the intro and outro to this show is from this movie.
Like, I think that's really impressive, you know, for something like this to have so many, like, memorable lines. I mean, look, Chris Jericho made a career out of using this line.
Oh, God, yeah.
A long time.
Yeah, and you know what? And it's funny because we mentioned last week that George Miller likes to look at these as silent films. He wants people to watch it and know what's going on without really listening to the dialogue. But despite that, you're right. There are some really, really memorable lines in this. Speaking of memorable, I fucking love this boomerang taking out this troop. Boomerangs were a huge thing in the 80s. I know how I had one. I'm shocked that it's only used in like this one scene. We don't really see it again, do we, Mick?
No. But it's interesting again in that it's one of these explicitly Australian things that crops up in this movie in a fun context.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the feral kid, for some reason, has a boomerang that's made of steel and clearly has razor-sharp edges so that if it hits you, you're kind of in trouble, and he has some kind of net to catch it with. I love this. I love this so much. I think also it's the kind of... I don't know if you've read much about a former child actor who played the feral kid, Emil Minty?
No.
Okay. He didn't find out until he was an adult, in fact, until he was well into his 20s, I think, that he's actually of Aboriginal origin.
Oh, wow.
He'd been adopted as a child, but he didn't realize that his birth mother's Aboriginal. But he's talked about in interviews, I've heard him say that when they were making this film, he's out in the desert, he's got a boomerang, and he said, it's something felt very, very right about being in that setting and having that weapon. And later on he's pondered, was this him on some level remembering his ancestry? It's certainly interesting, though it's maybe
definitely
slightly regrettable that the first time somebody Aboriginal turns up in one of these movies, it's accidental.
Oh, this is up there with like the glaive and all those other big like weapons. And you could tell he's like the only person who knows how to hold it because there's like one section for the grip. And if you don't grab that, you're in trouble.
Humongous is getting pushed back from his clan, and he says that they will do things his way while choking out one of his troops here. Humongous then gives them the order to walk away, and he gives them one full day to decide, which I thought was nice of him. You have one day to decide what you're going to do.
Yeah, he's a reasonable guy, you know.
Exactly.
It's interesting that it's framed that way, and then again we have at least one person in the compound thinks that seems like an offer, and seems to believe that he won't really just have them all murdered. I think obviously he will just have them all murdered.
Yeah.
There's no reason to think him a trustworthy actor. I love the fact that there's a discussion and that there's a back and forth.
Yeah, create some debate for sure. We see Max confer with this boy and this music box. We're hearing from Papa Gallo that the first step is to defend the fuel. Max adds that if you want to get out, talk to him. Max says to do the job, he needs 5 gallons of gasoline and some high-octane gas, and they tell him that he has a deal. So I'm liking the strategy here. You know, we saw it earlier too, where Max is up in a cliff, he's looking through binoculars, he's trying to decide how to attack, and we're seeing that here. He's planning stuff, and it's not all just off the cuff, although as we'll see, it kind of goes off the rails a bit.
Well, for a movie with this many characters, and it's as blunt of a premise as you can have, nobody's an idiot, which I always appreciate in these kind of stories. You know, they give him just enough fuel to get this done, but not enough where if he tries to run away, he'll survive for long, and the people are also suspecting that, yeah, Humongous will come back and just kill us if we don't do it, so we have to move.
Yes, and also, I like that at this point, Wes is angry because the feral kid has killed his lover with the boomerang. And I also like the fact that we've had that little detail of that the Humongous has a hype man. I like the fact that the Humongous has that sort of MC character who introduces him, and then he loses his fingers by trying to catch the boomerang, and everyone else just laughs. I love that moment. Just as, again, it's such a strange moment as well, but then it's just immediately followed by all of this laughter. And when I was doing some more research for this, I thought I'd go look at how this film was marketed in Australia, because I'm familiar with how it was marketed in Europe and North America, but I'd never looked at any of the Australian marketing materials for this. And there's this thing it says in all of, like, the Australian newspaper ads for this movie, and it says, "It's our Star Wars."
Oh, interesting.
And what does it say about Australia if their Star Wars has, you know, a guide where somebody loses their fingers? What does that tell us about Australia?
We're seeing preparations as Max lifts the gasoline and is promptly stopped. We see the boy howling at the moon like Ozzy as Max continues his preparations.
Well, look, I mean, if Black Sabbath showed up as one of the gang, I don't think anybody would be that surprised.
No, not likely. We cut to Gyro, who's dragging this trunk with his cuffs, and the dog once again approaches him. Max has Gyro finish carrying the gas, and he's reminding Max what lingerie is, which I thought, just a goofy conversation here.
No, I like the idea that the Gyro captain would constantly be kind of, he'd be sort of the annoying post-apocalypse equivalent of those people who say, "Do you remember the 90s? Do you remember that show on Nickelodeon? You know, didn't you want to get gunged?" That he'd be that guy. But also, I like the fact that he's talking about lingerie. I think that's great. Do you remember lingerie? Yeah, that's...
Max finds some dice and some shells as well as a shotgun, and then he goes to the machine, which flies overhead. We cut to Max trying to start a truck, and he leaves Gyro with some dice, and he drives away.
Yeah,
they're not partners.
Yeah, much like Star Wars, God, these franchises love their fucking dice.
Yes, they do. As we'll discuss in a few weeks. We're seeing the guy with the red mohawk. He gets his hair trimmed. This is Wes, right?
Yeah, Wes.
Okay, we're seeing Wes get his hair trimmed as he turns and sees Max. So they get in their vehicles, and we get some more great car collisions and camera angles as Gyro looks down from his helicopter. This stuff is fucking fantastic. I love the action scenes in this movie.
Yeah, no, the action scenes in this film are just, they're splendid. They're really frenetic, really exciting. Yeah, there's a, you know, especially compared to how staid a lot of this kind of action filmmaking had gotten at that point. You know, there were very safe procedural ways of shooting things, and that's not to say that this film wasn't shot with the safety of the cast and crew and stunt performers in mind, but rather this film's taking kind of creative risks with how it's shot. You know, like, there's a lot of handheld. There's a lot of frenetic energy to it, and yeah, it's great. It's not simply that this is some very good stunt work, it's the fact that it's shot in a really frenetic and exciting way, which still feels fresh.
Yeah, and in fact, from what I'm hearing, the movie that's going to end this retrospective is kind of shot the same way. Like, he didn't really change that way of shooting these films, for sure.
A lot of people could be much more eloquent and have said, I think, what needs to be said. I still think this is, from top to bottom, one of the most efficient action movies you'll ever see.
Humongous loads up this huge pistol as Max's shotgun peters out. He shoots Max's truck and he barrels through a tent, apparently interrupting a sex session.
Well,
again, just the rudeness of this movie, which, you know what, I'm not going to put it down for that. I'm just saying, I love the sleaze associated with this.
Oh, but
go
but
ahead.
We see one of those tent lovers again later.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's good that he's kind of, we're given this one moment where we see them as sort of at least human at this point. Also, this is the thing that's sort of carried over from the first film. This movie is also kind of horny.
Oh, definitely.
You know, there's a lot of homoeroticism in this movie. There's a lot of sexual energy just being expressed.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just from the wardrobe on, you get that. Gyro grabs Chekhov's snake, and he throws it on someone who shoots the driver of their vehicle, and it crashes. Great moment there. They stand at the gate as someone is thrown off, and really cool flamethrower here. This is just some good stuff.
Yeah.
Max gets a hold of the flamethrower and is told he can run, but he can't hide. Gyro tells everyone not to touch his helicopter as the kid growls at him. And this is when the kid kind of started getting on my nerves, Matt. We've hit that moment.
Yeah, it does. It sort of does, yeah.
No, the kid remains great throughout this.
You don't get annoyed when he's growling like this?
No. I think this seems perfectly in character and totally valid.
It reminded me of, you know, when we watched Logan, Matt, and I had some complaints about that kid because it was the same way. It was just growling every single time she was on screen, and I just don't like kids who express themselves like this. It's just really weird.
Yeah, it's because you don't have kids, because there's a point when they will actually do this.
Yeah, I certainly don't. It seems very natural to me. You know.
Okay.
Children will occasionally just go, "Rrr."
Gyro says that the machine might be able to take two. They're told that they have 12 hours to fix the truck. Max is told by one of the villagers that she was wrong about him, and she apologizes.
Virginia Hay, whom
you
might remember, turns up in... Oh, what's the first Timothy Dalton Bond from Living Daylights?
She's in that?
She's in The Living Daylights, wow. And she is later in the TV series Farscape.
Oh, okay.
She's a series regular in the TV show Farscape.
And this isn't a knock, but she seems way too attractive to be in this village. Okay.
No, it's not that she's too attractive, it's that she's the only person in this film with really great hair.
Yes.
Everyone else looks like they're cutting their own hair, and hers is great. Hers looks like, she still has access to styling products.
Yeah.
Well, she's probably got her own supply in her tent.
Yeah, probably, you know. So the actress who asks if there's room for two on the gyrocopter, because we're at the start of the subplot about gyro captain and the young woman in the compound, that actress was 15. I don't think she's meant to be underage in this film. But the Australian actress Archie Whiteley, weirdly, I've only ever seen her in two things, and in both of them she's playing straight up adult. She's in Razorback. Have you seen Razorback?
Oh, God, yeah. The Killer Pig movie.
Emphasis on the Killer Pig movie.
Yes.
But she plays, the research student.
Oh, okay.
Again, this is like only a year or 2 years later, and, still not an adult, but we buy her completely playing grown-ups. It's a reverse of what normally happens. You know, we normally have 25-year-olds playing high schoolers. This actress is sadly no longer with us. Her playing range kind of had tipped into adulthood long before she was old enough to drink or drive.
Russell Mulcahy, right?
Razorback.
I saw that when I was way too young, I think.
Yeah, okay. Shot in the same part of Australia with the same cinematographer.
Oh, wow, interesting.
So there's a lot of visual overlap.
Max is being shown some gratitude as he exits the village. Humongous, he comes back and promises because they defied him, nobody will get out alive.
Yeah.
And we're getting a weird montage of Humongous preparing his men here. For some reason, Miller likes to put montages in his films. I mean, this was, 2 years after Rocky II. Like, it's just weird to see montages in Mad Max films.
Well, it's nice. We get a good sense that, a terrible night of torture and, morale-boosting depravity is happening in the Humongous encampment.
Max sees the kid once again playing the music box, and he throws him a bag telling him to leave. And this is pretty much how I am with my cats. This is how I get them to leave. I thought that line would get more traction. They end up letting
2 hours of sleep. I would.
Okay, all right. They end up letting Max go, saying that he's honorable and he's fulfilled his duties. Max drives off. They catch up to his car and bump it over the ledge as they take his gas. We see the dog get shot. Why does George Miller fucking love killing these dogs? Well, this is the guy who make Happy Feet like 20 years later.
On screen. That's the only
No, you don't see it on screen. It's out of frame, but you still hear him yelp.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's sad.
Max pulls himself out of the wreckage. He wakes up as it explodes. Yes.
Yes, the booby trap from earlier. Chekhov's booby trap. And the toady, the little Humongous MC guy gets blown up, which is also great. He has no luck.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Max wakes up on the edge of the helicopter as Gyro tells him to relax. We cut to him laying in bed as the kid pokes in with a chicken lurking inside. And we're seeing this feral kid. He gives him his clothes. We once again see a plan of attack happening as Max walks in and says that he'll drive the tanker, no deals required, saying that he's the best chance they have. He loads up his shotgun and then everyone's off to fight.
Yeah.
We cut to Humongous as the kid is moved and Max pulls him onto the truck and the fight is on. Humongous fires away at the tanker. As Gyro, he's hit. Explosions galore happen as we cut to the highway and the tanker is being pursued. Again, just a fantastic action scene here.
It's amazing nobody died when you really look at the
yes.
fact of this. I mean, somebody almost did. There was a stunt where a guy who's driving like the ATV or like that smaller vehicle and hits that sand dune, and you see him do a somersault in the air. Apparently, like, it was just supposed to be shot out like a cannon, and he flipped so much that he broke both his legs, and I mean, it could have been a lot worse, amazingly. Yeah. But yeah, this 20 minutes, not even, I could watch this, like, until the day I die and be perfectly content. Like, this is still, I would put at the top five, like, greatest climactic sequences you'll ever see in an action movie.
The stuntman who did that flip, where he broke his legs, Guy Norris is his name, and he comes back to this franchise. He is the stunt coordinator and second unit director of Fury Road.
Oh, wow.
So the last stunt he performed as a stuntman, because he only works as a coordinator now, is the last stunt he performed was the vehicle roll at the start of Fury Road. But have you guys seen the little making of documentary about this?
I've seen snippets of it. I don't think I've ever watched in its entirety.
Yeah, I watched it. It's on YouTube and it's fascinating because they have this moment, you know, where that stunt goes wrong, and the voiceover person helpfully points out that because George Miller is also a qualified medical doctor, he's attending, you know, the scene of the accident on his film. It's just delightful.
Bombs are thrown, and I love how this car is driving while on fire for a few seconds before going off the road and exploding. Just great stuff there. The girl is shot while on the tanker and is just hanging off of it until she's pulled off. Max shoots a car, and I love this stunt of somebody flying over the top of it. Again, I'm just pointing these stunts out as I'm watching this movie. Like, this is just one of those just gripping action scenes.
Yeah.
I like this motorcycle that gets pulled under as he tries to shoot the tire. That was a nice little shot as well.
The tent lever? Mr. Tent
yes.
lever? It just is a, man, he has no luck.
No, none. Max shoots another guard off the truck as, and Matt, I mean, we talked about Raiders of the Lost Ark last year. I mean, this scene could literally be right from that. Right?
Yeah, I mean, it's same year, same vehicles almost. You know, it's a big trucker.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of it. Yeah, very, very coincidental, but I think this is just as good as what you see in Raiders. Not going to say it's better.
Definitely.
Because it's, you know, it's also doing very much its own thing.
And Wes hops on and tries taking a sledgehammer to it. And Matt, I think you hit it on the head. Like, this was a homosexual relationship, and this guy's just taking out the loss of his lover on everybody, huh?
Oh, yeah, this becomes a, if you look at it from the wrong side, it's a gay revenge film.
Well, yeah. It's also, are you familiar with the Iliad?
With what?
The Iliad? You know, the
Homer.
Ancient Greek, yeah, the Greek epic about, you know, Troy, the Battle of Troy.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It's supposed to be, I've sort of read that Wes losing his lover and making him sort of full of rage is supposed to be a reference to, I want to say Achilles, his lover Patroclus getting killed.
Oh, that's right, yeah, the boy he was training.
Oh, well, yeah, I think in the film Troy, they make Patroclus his cousin or something.
Yeah.
They really back away from the idea that these are gay lovers and make him his cousin. But yeah, I think that's kind of, I don't think it's come up, but George Miller's parents were Anatolian Greek. There are a number of weird references, like ancient Greek mythology, amongst other things, in these films. So that apparently is one of them.
It does kind of make sense when you realize that the luggage is really a Trojan horse in a lot of ways.
Oh, yes!
Humongous approaches as the tires are finally shot. Gyro throws a grenade on a car before he's shot down. Max tells the kid to get a bullet shell on the truck, and I love this because, like, Max is running out of shells. He's got this one bullet just hanging on the hood of this car, and he tells the kid to go get it. I wouldn't expect for Max to put the kid in danger like this, but that's what he's doing here.
Yeah, Max, our sympathetic protagonist.
Yes. The kid reaches for the bullet as Humongous, what's he do, turn on the NAS here, I guess, right, Matt?
Oh, this is great with the freaking sandwich between the truck and Humongous's.
Yeah. Wes attacks again as Max collides with another truck.
He collides with Humongous's truck.
Yeah, he collides with Humongous.
Has doubled back.
Yeah. I kind of lost track of what was going on. Why did he double back here?
I think the Humongous was trying to play chicken with Max, but didn't realize just how distracted the driver of that truck is.
Okay. And we also learn here that there wasn't gas on this truck. It was actually sand.
Yes.
So
after we get the spectacular truck roll.
Yeah.
A stunt no one had done before. Have you read about the making of this one particular sequence? That wasn't a stunt driver, because stunt drivers don't know how to drive that kind of vehicle, or at least they didn't in 1981, because nobody did stunts with that kind of vehicle. So they had hired an actual truck driver called Dennis Williams, and they'd initially hired him to, you know, drive the truck, but you know, that kind of vehicle has a very complicated gearing system that takes a while to learn, and... Yeah, they didn't fancy their chances of getting any of their stunt drivers to up to speed with it on time, so they had an actual truck driver doing it. And sort of gradually through degrees, and I guess a lot of this is to do with sort of just the culture of macho, but originally it was just going to be a collision and not the truck actually rolling onto its side. And eventually just, I think the truck driver telling tall tales kept talking about how sometimes when you're driving across the outback and the winds are strong, you can kind of feel your vehicle tilting and almost going onto two wheels and all of this. And I think the driver wanting to impress perhaps these stunt performers or these, you know, people making a motion picture kind of seems to have talked himself into performing this dangerous stunt. So,
it is a very dangerous stunt. Man. Yeah. You can't fake this.
Yeah. They didn't let him eat for 12 hours beforehand. In case they had to, you know, take him for surgery, in case this all went horribly wrong. That's a regular trucker, not a trained stunt person doing that stunt. Every time I ponder this, I just get nervous.
Yeah, like, could you imagine you're being told not to eat for 12 hours in preparation of the fact that you might go to the hospital and need surgery?
Yeah.
Wow.
But here's the thing. No one was doing vehicular stunts with that kind of vehicle at this point. But over, like, the next 10 years, we see a couple of people attempt to sort of outdo this, right? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the truck chase at the end of License to Kill, or Terminator 2.
Yeah.
Where the entire sort of LA River truck chase is very much James Cameron sort of saying, hold my beer to this movie.
Gyro proves to still be alive as Max cracks a smile and the kid leaves with a final monologue about the fuel being hidden in the vehicle as he grew up to be a man and the Road Warrior only lives on in his memories as credits roll on Mad Max 2 Road Warrior. Alright boys, scale of 1 to 10, how do we feel about Mad Max 2? Mick, you go ahead and go, sir.
God, I mean, it would just be rude to give this anything less than a 10, wouldn't it?
10,
it would just
really?
Be rude, you know. Well, look, it's a game changer for this type of cinema. There's not an ounce of fat on this narratively. It's you know, perfectly structured. You know, there's some incredible filmmaking and visual storytelling in it. I'm not sure how, with those resources, anyone could have made a better film. So I'm going with a 10 here. And
wow. Perfect score. Wow. Very short and succinct rating there by Mr. Duffy. Matt?
Well, I can't believe I'm doing this, not just because I'm really tired and I keep seeing double vision. I'm pretty close to Nick as far as if I was a film teacher, which I am not, for the record, and had to show a movie about just expert storytelling outside of proving you don't need extensive dialogue or plot machinations. You can be as streamlined and as efficient as you can be with a movie through action. I think this is the standard. There's a couple other movies that really do it well with characterization and through a lot more thematic stuff. You know, stuff like Aliens comes to mind, certainly the first Terminator. But for what this is, as far as, much like Raiders of the Lost Ark, I think this is up there as a cornerstone for not just one genre. At any time, I think there's a movie that's that much of a game changer and a landmark, a standard bearer that transcends genre. Like this one of those things where it's just a great movie beyond just an action movie. And there's a reason why this was on HBO all the time, not just because it's 90 minutes and you can get 12 runs out of it on a day, seemingly. I think it is that good. I was scared to go back to it, because I always hate when we do these movies that we have such a huge mark on the cinematic landscape, and having to be the guy who says, oh, it lives up to the hype, or in some cases, like, you know, go back to the Empire Strikes Back review, I don't always agree. I'm thankfully in the former, and I didn't think I was going to do this, because I had a 9 written down when I was sat down to watch this, but I'm like, you know what, I'm feeling generous, and I do think it does fit my criteria. I am also going to give this a 10.
Holy shit.
Come on, Scrooge. Come on, Scrooge.
You guys, I can't believe you put me in this position. Let me say, I do, obviously, as I've said throughout this podcast, I do think this is a pretty big improvement over last week's film, for sure. Starting the action last week was pretty much two bookends. This week, we have it scattered throughout the entire film. But I am still waiting to be a fan of this franchise. And I can't look at a movie like this without characterizations and say that I felt like it was a really good movie. I think Gibson, as I've mentioned, is better here. I think the main villain is better here. And obviously the action is even better. The music is better. Everything about it is better, but it's still kind of not my jam. Even saying that, though, I cannot disrespect the work that went into the quality of the stunts in this movie. I can't disrespect the action scenes in this movie. I'm going to give this a 7. It's higher than the 6 from last week. But I think there's going to be a moment when I do turn and say, yeah, I am a fan of this movie. And who knows, maybe it's going to be the movie we're going to talk about in a few weeks. But as great as the action is here, I just didn't feel the characterizations. So 7 out of 10 for me on Mad Max 2 Road Warrior after 2 10s. Wow, I was not expecting these reviews.
Yeah, so I just after that 7, I've only one thing to say.
What's that?
You can run, but you can't hide. You know, that's really all I can say to you at this point.
What are we going to feel, though? Are we going to feel like hiding next week when we talk about Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, the third movie in this franchise, and one that a lot of people look at, as Matt mentioned last week, as kind of the weakest of the franchise? I haven't watched anything but bits and pieces. Well, when I was growing up, I watched bits and pieces. Like I said, it was on TV all the time, but I'd never actually seen the whole thing through until I was gearing up for Fury Road. I don't have too many fond memories of it. Mick, what are you expecting when we talk about Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome next week?
I think we're going to be talking a lot about Tina Turner. I can promise a fun production anecdote about Tina Turner.
Save it for next week. Okay. Matt, what are you expecting next week?
Master Blaster level of explosions and verbal sparring. Because
really?
I have a great deal to say, and it's probably not going to be popular. So I'll feel like you.
Well, I was positive on this movie for the most part. Yeah, like I said, I mean, there are definitely thoughts I have as well. And I'm going to save those for next week. But my real memory of it was kind of the Moonraker of this series, where it starts off like you remember Mad Max movies being, and then it just kind of goes off the rails by the end. But that'll come next week when we talk about Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. But until next week, I'm here just for the podcast. Thank you, gentlemen.
How does it feel? It hurts. Out here, everything hurts. You want to get through this? Do as I say.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast, exclusively on Percolated Media.
Welcome to another edition of Thunderdome!
Join us next week for an entirely new review.
Anything I say. What a wonderful philosophy you have. Take him away.
And if you enjoyed this podcast, please take a look at some of our other retrospectives, where we delve film by film into such other franchises as Star Wars, the Incredibles movies, the Planet of the Apes franchise, Indiana Jones, the films of the DC Universe featuring Batman and Superman, and so many more.
The Toe Cutter! He knows who I am! I am the Night Rider!
If you would be so kind, please take a moment to give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
The men, who are they?
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
how the hell did you get all this together?
Just have a mix, you know, piece from here to piece from there.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
I can do this. I know this machine.
He does. He's a red hat.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett. And a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
What do you suppose he's gonna do?
Retaliate first.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is for review and discussion, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
We ever saw of him. He lives now, only in my memories.
Because, you know, Filmways had, you know, as we discussed, distributed the first film.
I mean, this set the paradigm for a lot of post-apocalyptic type of films. I mean, they were making rip-offs of this movie well into the noughties with, what was that Neil Marshall
Doomsday
movie?
Doomsday.
I mean, that's like the love child of Escape from New York and the Road Wars, and it's also fucking terrible.
I saw that in theaters.
Yeah.
It's really bad.
Me too. I saw
it as well.
So we were the three.
Well, it's also kind of not to sidetrack things with a little diss against Neil Marshall, but man, Doomsday is very much an English person's movie about how terrified he is of Scotland.
I never thought of it in that way. Honestly, I haven't seen it since it was out, so I couldn't tell you one way or the other. All right, so as the credits start, I'm sorry, I already said that. So we're hearing that
this score is in stereo.
Yeah.
Feels a lot more urgent and exciting.
Yeah. Matt, would you agree?
Yeah, but, you know. No, my reputation is scores.
I always like to throw it to you just in case.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna keep bunting until there's one where I can actually hit a home run.
We're getting.
So it's kind of like there is at least a joke in the middle of it with the yes. Sorry, one second. I'm being interrupted. Sorry.
They're looking for gasoline on the other line.
I guess so.
Sorry about that.
It's all right.
It's something, right?
Yeah. All right. Mick, where were you?
Where was I? We were talking about how gratuitous the rip scene is.
Yeah.
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 It's.
And we're hearing from, is it Papagallo?
Papagallo, yes.
Papagallo. We're hearing from Papagallo.
This movie is also kind of horny.
Oh, definitely.
You know, yeah. there's a lot of homoeroticism in this movie. There's a lot of sexual energy just being expressed.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just from the wardrobe on, you get that. Matt?
Do I even need to add my...
No, you don't. You don't. I'll move on.